I'm Katie, and you're listening to the Home Ed Voices podcast, where I talk to people about their home education adventures and experiences here in the UK. This week, I'm chatting to Naomi Fisher, the author of Changing Our Minds, How Children Can Take Control of Their Own Learning. We talk about how home-educated children relate to their peers, the long process of deschooling, internal and external motivation, and supporting ADHD and autism in the home education community. And now, on with the episode. This week, I'm talking to Naomi Fisher, who is a clinical psychologist. She is the home educating parent of two children who've never been to school, and she's the author of the new book, Changing Our Minds. Thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Katie.
To get started, tell me about your home educating experience and how you got started.
How we got started. So I didn't plan to be a home educator. When my children were young, when my first child was young, my son, we had a place at the local primary school down the road, and it was meant to be a really good primary school. And he was a July birthday, so he was just going to be four when he started school. And I had done, I'm a psychologist, so I'd done a lot of studying about play, how children learn, development, all of that kind of thing, before he went to school. And I tried to create this lovely play-based environment, and also not to put too, I'd read Unconditional Parenting, and I was trying to be non-punitive and unconditional with him. And then I went to the school information evening, and I thought, wow, suddenly I have no more choices about how people behave to him. You know, they were a great primary school. They had a golden time where you had to, you know, everyone in the class behaved well, you got special time to choose what you did on Friday afternoons. And they gave me a list of keywords which they wanted me to teach him over the summer. And these were words like the and, but, if, of. And my son was three at the time. And I looked at this list and I was just like, I just cannot see how I'm going to even get him to look at this list of words.
Was this to teach him to read those words?
Yes.
He would recognise them and know what they were.
Exactly. They wanted him to come into school in September, going into reception, already able to read these words.
Right.
So that, you know, give him a head start kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I just thought, this is learning that's completely decontextualised from what he is interested in and what he wants to do. And so far in his life, all of his learning has been through what he wants to do and what he's interested in. And, you know, we had shaped our environment, as pretty well all parents of young children do, around the things that he was interested in. So he was interested in Angry Birds. So we had lots of Angry Birds everywhere, and we used to play real life Angry Birds and set up, you know, that people do.
Yeah.
And I just thought, so I've now meant to put him into this system where learning is something that you just do because an adult tells you to do it, not because it's something you really want to know about. And that felt really wrong to me. And I could see that it would feel really wrong to my son too, and he would resist. And we would end up actually in a really, I thought things could go quite badly wrong for us quite quickly.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, we'll just won't do that. We will just skip it and we'll do some home ed instead. And at the time, like so many other parents, I thought we'll do that till he's about seven, maybe. Then he'll have grown up a bit, you know, we'll be ready for him to go to school.
Yeah.
And of course, as he got older and older, the path that we were taking and the path that school were taking just got further and further and further apart rather than closer together.
Yeah.
And it began to seem more and more absurd that I had ever thought that we would just send him to school when he got to a certain age. So that was how, and then when my daughter came along, and it was just made sense to keep her as well, her home as well. And we came into unschooling really through my son, I would say, because he resisted any form of instruction so strongly that it was enough. It was enough for me to suggest that he might want to play Minecraft for him to refuse to look at it for about a year. So really, there was no way I was going to sit him down at the table and teach him anything. That, you know, I could see that anything that I did, in fact, became something he didn't want to do. So, right, okay, so we had to follow a different path, and we found unschooling. Then as my children got a bit older, so I've got a daughter who's 3 years younger as well, and as they got a bit older, it became clear that their interests were absolutely, completely divergent. So there was almost nothing on which they overlapped, apart from a bit of Minecraft, which they did later get into once another child showed it to them. So my son likes to spend lots of time on the computer, on the tablet. He liked to do coding. He liked to do like strategy games and logic puzzles. My daughter was all about social sensory play, ideally with as many other children as possible. So we were in the situation where I was spending most of my time with one child either saying, can we go out? Can we go out? Can we go out? Or the other child saying, can we go home? Can we go home? Can we go home? And it became really stressful. And I was like, I'm this one adult to two children, and yet I really can't manage to meet both of their needs all the time, because they weren't very, at that stage in their lives, they weren't terribly flexible about their needs. So it wasn't like I could say to my son, okay, let's go to the home ed group. And, you know, if we stay there for 3 hours so that my daughter can play, then we'll come back. He just hated it. And just after half an hour, he would be intensely, really, really wanting to leave, which made it really difficult for my daughter to get the time she wanted. Anyway, so to cut a long story short, I really wanted to find a community for them to be part of where I felt they could both get their needs met in a way that didn't involve me having to cut myself down the middle. So we actually went to France for 2 years, and they went to a self-directed school there, which was a Sudbury model school. And that was a place where literally the children get there every morning and they can choose what they do all day. There were about 40 children, and the place was set up like they had a kitchen where they could cook their own food. They had a computer room. They had a music room. They had an art room, and they had lots of kids running around. It was really good. They really liked it. And then COVID happened and the school closed, and it became very difficult for us to live in France. And so we actually came back to the UK last year. And now they go to the self-managed learning community in Hove, which is a part-time learning community where all the children are officially home educated or unofficially home educated. But you know what I mean? It's not a school. Yeah, so that's us.
So the school actually, the school in France actually closed?
No, well, it did close when lockdown happened.
Do you mean it closed for lockdown, or it actually is a more permanent matter?
It closed for lockdown.
Right.
They have reopened, but we weren't sure that they would reopen, because many of these schools, as people will know, are really fragile, because you know, it relies on the pupil, on the fees in order to pay the rent, and if you can't pay the rent, you can't pay the staff, and numbers were dropping off really rapidly because parents were losing their job, you know, the whole thing that happened in lockdown. And so we thought, and lockdown in France was really brutal. I mean, we found lockdown hard in the UK, but in France, there was a whole nother level of policing, literally policing. There were police on the streets. You had to fill in a form every time you left the house. All the parks were closed, not just the playgrounds, the parks. And we were in Paris. So it was, and we had no outdoor space, or in an apartment. We were only allowed to take the children out for 1 hour a day to walk along the pavements. And there was even a rule in Paris that you weren't meant to exercise between 10 and 7 in the day. You were allowed to walk. You were only really meant to be out for essential trips, right? So like, I would take them out scooting, and we got stopped by the police, and the police said you shouldn't be scooting between this time.
Walking.
Yes. Yes, exactly that. And we would go every, and you're only allowed 1 kilometer from your house as well. And every day we would go out and we would just do the same circuit, and we would go round the edge of the park. And it was so sad because everybody was round the edge of the park, you know, the outside, on the pavements, on the roads, looking into this park that we couldn't go into. And we just thought, no, we need to, if this is going to happen again, as it obviously it has, we need to be somewhere where we can at least go outside and not think that the police are going to stop us in this, and they don't in the same way here. It's just not the same, you know. So that's why we came back.
Without wanting to get on too much of a tangent, given what's going on in France with regards to home education and the you know, the concerns that actually they're going to, you know, it's going to be made illegal, is that, do you think, what knock-on do you think that's going to have to smaller schools that are allowing their pupils to be autonomous? Do you think they're going to get folded into those restrictions?
It's an interesting thing, and they're fighting it, obviously. The interesting thing about France is they have always had a kind of reverse situation to how we have in the, what we have in the UK. So in the UK, generally, up to this time, it's been quite easy to home ed, in the sense that you don't have people coming and testing your children and that kind of thing, and you don't have to follow a curriculum. But it's really hard to set up a school. There are lots of rules that you have to fit, and you can't, you know, there are lots of the learning communities get around that by only opening for a certain number of hours a week so that they're not classed as a school. In France, it's relatively easy to set up a school, but hard to home ed. So actually, there are lots more of these self-directed schools because they don't have the same system with Ofsted. They have inspections, but the inspectors don't have the power to close you down. And the inspections are largely about things like, is the building safe? Are your pupils safe? Rather than what are you actually teaching them? So, and that means, I think, that a lot of French children who would be home educated if they were in the UK are in these self-directed schools because there's nowhere, you know, there's nowhere else for them to be. but they are also unfair. Unfortunately, as they're proliferating, the French government is waking up to their presence and is starting to, you know, do all the things that governments do with home education.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting you're saying about how different your children are and how different their needs of their, you know, that in being autonomous, they can have very different needs. And I think one of the things that's really helpful in your book is you actually do give example, you know, like you talk about, not specifically your children, but you talk about how in an autonomous education, there needs to be autonomy for everybody in the household. And sometimes that means that you actually need to... You employ strategies.
Yeah, absolutely.
To make that happen.
Yes, it doesn't just happen, because otherwise the loudest voice becomes the most powerful one, the one who gets the most autonomy. And that can happen in any community, I think, and certainly in a family as well. Yes, and one of the things I talk about in my book is that I think, and I don't think anyone's done any research on this, but this is what I observe from looking around me. I think that when we don't send children to school, they are more different than each other. They are more diverse because we're not standardizing them. So we're enabling them to follow their interests. And the more they follow their interests, the more they kind of develop their unique identity and their unique personality. So I think always think home ed groups are fabulous because you look at them and the kids are just so different. There are so many different ways of being in the world that you see. And actually, if you visit a group of schooled kids, you don't see that in quite the same way because they've all been taught they have to behave in the same way, which doesn't happen in home ed groups and in self-directed schools, actually, same thing.
Yeah. Do you think that, I mean, obviously part of that feels like it's because of the, as you say, like the sort of structure of control that is used by schools.
Yeah.
My instinct is that what I've seen is it changes, home educated children have different peer relationships.
Yeah, they do.
And they treat their peers and their peers treat them very differently than how I treated my peers and how my peers treated me within a school environment.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think there's a number of factors for that. One is that home educated children are not as dependent on their peers as schooled children are, because schooled children have no choice about their peer group and they can't leave if they want to leave. So they can't say, you know what, I've had enough of this, let's go, which home educated children can do. And I think that makes a big difference. I also think there's not the same element of competition that you see, because school ranks children, you know, whether they're explicit about it or not. You know in the school who the bright, in quotes, children are, who the not so bright ones are. And in fact, there is research that shows if you ask children at the age of 5 or 6, they'll already be able to rank the children in their class as to who's clever and who's less clever. And when I ask my children about those things, they look at me blankly because that just doesn't happen in their life. You know, no one is ranked on a particular ability in the way that you are at school. So in school, your ability to read and write and do maths is so important that everybody really knows whether you're good at it or not, because people will react to you differently if you're good at all these things and if you're not good at all these things. But in home ed, you know, you can, one child might be really good at reading, another child might be really good at Minecraft, someone else might be really good at making clay models or singing or all that kind of thing. And it's all kind of on an equal level. There's no one's being tested and no one's being ranked against each other. And I think that's something amazingly valuable, actually, that we see among home education.
Yeah, I think there's also you've touched upon this, that you don't have to be around those people all the time. So you can be around them socially and you can be around them within a particular group or, you know, whatever, you know, social group or group about a particular subject or idea or whatever, but you can have lots of time away from them as well.
Yes.
Meaning that you're not dependent
on their approval. There's no pressure cooker. Yeah, yes. There's no pressure cooker. Yes, and also, if they reject you, which does happen both in home ed communities and in school, yeah, it's not so devastating. Because at school, if your peers reject you, you have to keep going back every day and be the one person who no one will talk to or no one will play with or who's always the last one picked at PE. With home ed, you know, okay, so if you fall out with a group of kids at one group, you can just stop going and go to a different one and find somebody else. So there just isn't that kind of level of desperation of I've got to fit in with my peers. And I think when you've missed that out, sometimes it means that some of the more problematic kind of peer behaviours that you see in kids at school don't happen, aren't so powerful. They don't happen in the same way.
Yes, because it's not a massive, you're not having, if you're having a problem with one group,
yeah,
you can leave that group, but you don't have to leave all of the other groups.
Exactly, exactly. You
know, so it's not the same as having to leave an entire school.
No, exactly, which is a big thing to do. And in order to leave a school, you've got to convince your parents that you need to leave the school. And, it's not an easy thing to do.
And find another school.
Yes.
And find a place in that and all of that kind of
thing. Oh, really difficult. And then you've got a whole new group. And then you've got to make that work, haven't you? With home ed groups, you can meet other families. Okay, that doesn't really gel with us. We'll try somebody else. We'll try a different group. You can do that. You can't really do that with schools. You can't sort of hop in, I'll have a week here. Then I'll go off and see if I like this lot better. Doesn't work like that. Yeah.
And you talk in the book about like your own experience of going into a classroom where children had been schooled together for a long period of time and you were this new person.
Yes.
Who'd had a completely different experience.
Yes, and they just had no understanding of it at all. And I had very little understanding of them as well. It was a two-way thing. And you're just sort of expected to get on with it at school, aren't you? It's just like, it's not even the focus of what's happening at school, because, of course, school is about learning the curriculum. So the social side of it is often a kind of side issue. Yeah.
Anyway. Well, this is what's almost paradoxical about home education, is that... Mm. People outside it and new people coming into it are so concerned and stressed out about the socialization side. And yet schools will regularly tell their pupils, you're not here to socialize.
It's to socialize, it's bizarre, isn't it? Yes, absolutely.
And
And so many people's experience of school socialization, my own experience, is of being bullied. and that isn't really something I need to replicate for my kids.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, you talk a lot about the de-schooling process.
Yeah.
Is that just as much, do you think, about the peer side of things as the actual structure of schooling? Or do you think actually the sort of control structure of schooling is the bigger thing you have to actually de-school from?
Oh, that's an interesting question. For children, do you mean, or for adults?
I think the de-schooling of adults and the de-schooling of children...
They run hand in hand.
I think they're different things. Mm. I mean, as a home ed parent who's, my kids have never been to school.
Yeah.
And I'm still de-schooling.
Yeah. Yeah, because you were schooled, right?
Because I was schooled.
Yeah.
So I'm still going through that process and peeling off the layers.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess, I mean, it seems to me, and you talk about this, again, you talk about this in the book, that when you take a child out of school, as the adult, you have to sit on your hands and wait and it's not going to be comfortable. So I guess I'm talking about it more from the child's point of view.
Mm. Yes, I think children have to unpeel their own layers. And then there's a lot, I talk about this in my book as well, there's a lot of indoctrination about school that goes on. Early on, everybody talks about how great school is going to be. And there are books for children about how fabulous how much they're going to learn at school. And children are basically explicitly told that school is the place that they're going to learn things. And if they don't go to school, they won't learn things. So that makes it really hard for them to come out of school. And also, I think coming out of school is often portrayed as a failure or as dropping out. And I really wish we could change that. I really wish there could be a sort of feeling that we're choosing something different, just as one might choose, to go to a Steiner school or a Montessori school or something. And that isn't a failure. It's simply choosing something different. And really what I would love for home education was if it was seen as we're choosing something different because this one didn't work for us, rather than you failed at school, so that, you know, so you have to do something else. I think that really affects how children feel about themselves, and that often, unfortunately, the process that children go through leaving school makes them feel really bad about themselves, because there often is a degree of blame of that child. I mean, I had it myself when I was a teenager. I can't remember how much I talk about this in the book, but anyway, when we came back from the Congo and I went into secondary school aged 13 or 14, the absolutely awful time to come back into school, into British school system, I really, really disliked going to school, really disliked it, and also thought it was completely pointless, because I felt like I was ahead of what people were doing. I'd been to this international school in Congo. We were doing much more difficult stuff than we were doing in the school in the UK. I thought it was a complete waste of time, and I really didn't connect with my peers at all, and they didn't connect with me. The attitude of the teachers was very much, what can you do? If you stopped isolating yourself, for example, if you stopped doing this. So like it was crazy. I had one other person who I had got to know and who I was friends with, and she was in a different house to me, right? So we were all divided up into these houses, and we were spent pretty well all our time in our house, including break time, lunchtime. The room where you ate was in your house, so you weren't allowed to eat with friends from another house. And eating at school is such a loaded thing, because if you don't have somebody to sit with in the dining hall, where do you sit? You know, you go into this room and it's full of people and they're essentially hostile, and you're looking at them and thinking, I can't sit next to you. If I sit next to you, you're going to laugh at me. It was awful. And so I was breaking the rules every lunchtime, so that she and I, because she was also sort of alienated from her house, were sitting behind the back of the school on these stairs where we weren't meant to be. We weren't meant to be eating. And when I think about it, it was just madness that we were just trying to meet our basic needs to be able to eat somewhere we felt comfortable. And we got in trouble for it routinely. The teachers would come around, we'd be sent off, and then it would be, well, if you keep on sitting at the back there, of course you're not going to get to know the other kids. So it's always blamed on the child, as is my experience. And then that makes it really tough, because then when you come out of school, it's like, this is the ultimate failure. I can't do what I'm meant to do. And I think a lot of de-schooling for children is turning that around. So we think, no, you know, actually, it's not that you failed at school. It's that school was not right for you, and it's not right for everybody. And that's just how it is.
I mean, my eldest is 12.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, you know, obviously GCSEs and exams start looming ahead.
Yeah.
Which obviously are the anathema of trying to do things autonomously. Not that everything in my particular home education is wholly autonomous. What do you think you do about that sort of loom? You know,
Well, funnily enough, going to France helped me quite a lot with this, because in France they don't do GCSEs. They don't do exams at 16. They only do exams at 18 to go into university. And so they just don't have this kind of looming thing at 14 at all. And that did make me think, this is interesting. I wonder how much of this is really necessary. You know, if my children don't do GCSEs and then decide to do A-levels out of school, would that be a possibility maybe? You know, it made me think sort of outside the box in that kind of way, that I don't have to follow this pathway that we all do in the UK, because not everybody does. Other countries do it differently. The other thing I think is that, I think what we're aiming for, well, certainly what I'm aiming for, is young people who are doing things because they want to do it and they feel the purpose in it. And I think if our young people see that they want to go to university, for example, and they think, okay, I'm going to need to do some GCSEs for that, then I think you can do a GCSE as a self-directed learner. Do you see what I mean? Because the difference is, I'm going to need a maths GCSE in order that I can do this, and in order that I can do this, as opposed to school saying, right, you all need to do maths GCSE. Yes. And I think that just that tiny difference makes is everything, really. Because I find, and I think that's something I talk about a lot in the book, that when you want to learn and when you're in, it does, you don't even need to be interested, because sometimes I talk about motivation and different types of motivation. And yeah. sometimes people get caught up with us that this idea was that doesn't intrinsically motivated mean they're only doing things they love. So, you know, what about the cleaning, or what about this thing that I don't love? How about if they never start to love whatever, maths? How's that going to work? But actually, motivation is a spectrum. And there are different forms of motivation which are still internally driven, and they're still higher quality than somebody saying, you've got to do this. So it's not really a choice between somebody saying, you must do this, and the child or young person saying, I love this, so I'm going to do it. There are also different forms of motivation where it's more about, okay, well, I want that goal, and therefore I'm going to do this. So, for example, with my son, he's never been someone who's done any writing, really. He's typed. He hasn't done writing. And just this last year, he said, I really want to get my handwriting a bit better. And he started practicing his handwriting. Now, I don't think he's doing that because he loves handwriting. In fact, I know he's not doing that because he loves handwriting. He finds it really hard. He wants to be better at handwriting, so he is doing it. But that is internally driven motivation, but not kind of passion led. Do you see what I mean? Yes. And I think we need to talk more about that kind of motivation, because I see that really developing in our children. And I think that's really important to know that that's higher quality. It's completely different than if I was saying to him, I really think you should do your handwriting now. I want you to focus on your handwriting. Then we'd be moving into the realm of external motivation. And I think that is damaging to learning.
Yes, and I can even see things like, you know, I mean, there are people, I'm sure, who really enjoy cleaning, but you do the cleaning because you
want a clean house, right?
You want a clean house. You want a tidy environment. Yes, exactly. You don't go, oh, I get to, I get to vacuum the stairs. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, no.
But you get to go upstairs and have clean stairs, and not go upstairs going, oh, God, they really need a vac.
Yes, and not the floor in the kitchen isn't sticky anymore. That kind of thing. It's a joy. But that's different to somebody else coming in and saying, you've got to clean this house now, isn't it? And it feels different. If I can connect with my own sense, the reason I'm doing this, I'm choosing to do this because I want to have a clean house.
Yes.
That feels very different to I'm being made to do this. And I think that's the line where we're trying, myself, that's where I'm trying to get with my children.
Yes. I'm aware that we are starting to run out of time. You talk in the book, but I you know, want to talk to you. You talk in the book about, you talk about sort of overdiagnosis and the risks of overdiagnosis of behaviour. And the sort of spiral with regards to like autism and ADHD and things. And the spiral of this person, their behaviour, is it driven by the environment? But if they're given a diagnosis, then they can be medicated. And anyway, then their behaviour is the diagnosis.
Yeah.
And the environment doesn't matter. It's the person needs changing, not the environment.
Yeah.
Obviously, within homeschooling, regardless of whether you took your child out of school or have homeschooled from the beginning, there are families who have autistic children, have children with ADHD and things like that.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the points you make and how, you know, with regards to sort of those families?
Absolutely, we can. And I think I want to start by saying that at no point am I saying any of these characteristics don't exist. So there's been a real thing in unschooling in particular, which I found absolutely horrible, where people have been saying, oh, autism and ADHD, they don't exist, and they wouldn't exist if the children weren't in school. Or even I've seen on Facebook groups people saying things like, it's just mothers wanting to feel special, really, really punitive kind of stuff. And I was aware when I was writing that book, this book, that I was treading a really delicate line between that and what I see in front of me and what I've seen in not so much in the home ed community, actually, because I think most people in the home ed community are very thoughtful about this. And they don't quite have the same pressures on them as families do in school. But I've worked in two different settings where I was diagnosing children with ADHD and autism. Right. So children were coming to me to be diagnosed, because I'm a clinical psychologist, so I can do that.
Yes.
And what was happening is they were coming and they were describing lots of difficulties at school. basically. That's sort of why a lot of the time that's why people get referred. Not always, but often it's because school are flagging up problems. I mean, that, you know, this is a massive generalization. I know there are lots of kids who get diagnosed earlier and for other reasons, but often it's because they're not fitting in to a school setting, or they're not fitting even in a nursery setting. They're not doing what is expected of them. And the focus in a diagnostic process is very much on the child. And that is just fact. There's a list of criteria that you go down. You know, is the child, are they doing this? Are they doing this? Are they doing this? Did they do this when they were younger? Did they do this when they were younger? Did they? And you, if they get enough ticks, then they get the diagnosis.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you know, it's more elaborate than that, but that is basically it. Are they showing these behaviors? Are they getting a diagnosis? The problem in my, the way I see it is that humans never exist out of context. Everything that humans do is determined by an interaction between who they are and the environment that they're in. So let's take ADHD, for example. So I would see a lot of six-year-old boys, okay?
Yes.
And I think it's in my book. There's ages we got referrals, six-year-olds, 11-year-olds, and 14-year-olds.
Right.
Okay, so these kids had started school. They were often quite young, their age group. They were really active little boys. They were being expected to sit down and listen and do things, and they couldn't do it. Okay, and that's, I completely agree. They could not do it. They were, they were bouncing around. They were not able to do it. And they fitted the criteria for the diagnosis.
Yeah.
And, but here was I thinking at the same time, I was home educating my kids at home, and I was thinking, I never make my kids sit down and try and listen and write things for, in fact, I never do at all, but I don't, you know, I would never do it, expect that they would be able to do it for several hours a day.
No.
And I would look at these kids and I thought, yeah, there's nothing actually wrong with you. And I think this is the point I'm going to make. And I think it's about neurodiversity, that there's a difference between saying, right, you are disordered. You need, and that is what the diagnoses say. Yes, unfortunately, it's in the name. ADHD, the D is diagnosed is disorder. ASD, the D is disorder. So there's an implication here that something has gone wrong with you, that you have something wrong. And I find that really distressing. I don't like that at all. And I much prefer the idea that we have a spectrum of human behavior, a spectrum of human characteristics, which is much wider than we really recognize at school.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there, you know, and some of those children, just by how they are born, how they are fully themselves, they are not ready to be sitting down in classrooms at age six. And and that doesn't mean that they're disordered. It just means they are them. But the system has no flexibility. So, well, the only flexibility in the system is diagnosis, perhaps special school, medication. The system is about saying that this child has something wrong with them, rather than saying, okay, so maybe these children actually would benefit from another 3 years perhaps of playing. And then, and as other countries do, so Denmark do have a play-based stage up to eight, for example. And I think if you do that, the a lot of the difficulties associated with that, how that child is, will disappear. That doesn't mean they're going to become a different person and suddenly they won't be impulsive and want to, you know, they won't be less hyperactive. They might still be like that, but it will be less of a problem. And that's what I'm saying. And I think that's what I'm saying with autism as well. It's not that they will become somebody different. It's that if we get the environment right, then the then they won't have so many difficulties because of it. And it won't be something that we necessarily need to make a huge thing about, because we can, as home educators, we can adapt the environment to what suits children. Whereas at school, it's about trying to fit the child into the environment of school, which is pre-decided. Do you see?
Yes, yes. I mean, you talk in the book about the criteria is for things like ADHD have expanded. As a clinical psychologist and somebody who's actually, you know, you're actually doing the diagnosing, is some of that expansion, for example, because girls, for example, weren't being diagnosed 30 years ago, and they are presenting differently, in part because of the sort of society's society's needs for girls to be different, and that's expectation of how girls are going to be.
So this is the question: is it about increased awareness, or is it about overdiagnosis, really, isn't it? That's what you're asking. And that's a question that's a very hot thing. Is it that we're now more aware of these problems and so we're able to diagnose these children who we weren't diagnosing before, and adults as well? Or is it that actually we're expanding these diagnostic criteria to a point where we are diagnosing a lot more people? This is a massive debate within mental health, psychology, psychiatry. There are whole books written on it. Yes. There's a great book called Saving Normal, which is written by the psychiatrist who was involved with the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, number 4, which was the one before the current one. And he talks particularly about ADHD, autism, and childhood bipolar disorder, actually, and said and talks about how the diagnostic criteria are widening and widening and widening, and including more and more children. And I think the key thing to get hold of, which I think is really important, is that there is no evidence that there is a categorically different group of children who fit this diagnosis, right? The diagnostic manuals try hard to divide people into categorical groups. You know, this group has this, this group has this. There is no evidence that humans work that way. All the evidence we have, including the genetic evidence, shows that all these things vary on dimensions. So when we do a diagnosis, we're basically drawing a line at a particular place and saying, okay, everybody on the left of this line, you've got this disorder. Everyone on the right of this line, you are, in quotes, normal. And we can move that line around. And the diagnostic criteria do move that line around. And the pharmaceutical companies have an interest in moving that line up so that more people are diagnosed, because it creates a market for their drugs. And we know that the pharmaceutical companies market these diagnoses. They because in the UK, a pharmaceutical company isn't allowed to market drugs. You know, you're not allowed to advertise drugs direct to consumers. You are in the US, and I find that really weird. You know, you can have adverts saying, take this brilliant antidepressant, it'll make you feel better. Yeah. In the UK, you're not allowed to do that. And so the way they get around that is they do market the diagnoses. So, and they don't usually do it overtly. They do it through things like awareness campaigns and articles in the press about how fabulous this diagnosis is and how it's changed my life to get this diagnosis. And this is a really well-documented process. Again, there are books about it. There's one called ADHD Nation, and there's another called Selling Sickness. And actually, I gave a talk, and somebody said in the chat, she said, I used to work for pharmaceutical companies, and this is what they did. We were doing this. So I feel quite confident that this really is happening, that they are promoting the diagnoses as an answer to people's problems. And what I saw when I was working in the neurodevelopmental clinics is that a diagnosis really isn't an answer to any problem, because a psychiatric diagnosis, which is what ADHD or autism are, isn't a diagnosis in the same way as a medical diagnosis. It's not like you've given a diagnosis for diabetes, now we know what the problem is, we can treat it.
Yes.
It isn't that. It's a description of how this person is at this particular time in this particular environment. And actually, what we can do before and after a diagnosis, when you're out of school, isn't hugely different. Isn't different, in fact, because you can do all the things. You can read all the books about how to help your child with autism or how to help your child with ADHD. And you can put all those things into practice, whether or not they've got a diagnosis. So, yes. But in school, the diagnosis is used as a gatekeeper often. Yes. So we would have these kids, they'd be sent off, it was awful, they'd waited for 2 years, they'd get a diagnosis, and then it would be us writing these long reports, and then school would now be able to make some adjustments because this child now has a diagnosis, which means they've officially got this problem. And that just felt really wrong to me, because it's still the same child, yes? Even if we'd said, and it was very hard for us as professionals to say, actually, I don't think you do fit this criteria. I think a diagnosis for you would better be, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder, because those diagnoses don't have the same, they don't have the same power in school. And so parents didn't want them. They wanted, and I can understand that completely. They wanted the diagnosis which was going to help them.
But because they need
help. Yeah.
Well, but I was going to say, because what you're giving is you're putting an official stamp that says this person can have help.
Because they have a disorder. Yeah. And that's the bit I feel is wrong. I feel we should be able to say this person needs help.
Yeah.
Full stop. Yeah. And this child needs something different. Full stop. We don't have to say they're disordered. That's what I would like to do.
But you need,
because
But within the school system, they're needing proof to, to be able to spend the money or to say, okay, well, now we will get, now there's an official thing, we can get somebody in who's going to give them one-to-one help.
Often,
Because otherwise, but, we it's not in our budget, we can't allocate this money because it's only there for official clinical diagnosis.
Exactly. But what I was seeing is this is so arbitrary. You know, this is just me. me and somebody else looking at this child. Why do you think that I have more say-so than the teacher who's taught this child for a year, the parents who've lived with this child for all this time? Why do I have to say, yes, this child has the right problems?
Yes.
You see?
Yes. Tell people where they can find you.
So Twitter is the best place to find me. My handle is @NaomiCFisher. And my book is Changing Our Minds, How Children Can Take Control of Their Own Learning, published by Little Brown. And it's on all the booksellers. You'll be able to find it very easily if you Google it.
Yeah, there will be links to Twitter, there'll be links to your book in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
You very much, Katie. It's been great.
Not a problem at all. Thank you. If you want to find out more about any of the things we talk about in this episode or to leave a comment, please go to the show notes of the blog at homeedvoices.co.uk or follow the link on Instagram @homeedvoicespodcast or Twitter @homeedvoices. This is episode 32. If you want to support the show, there are a number of things you can do. We really want to keep the podcast advert free, and we also really want to be able to pay our guests. And with that in mind, we've started a Patreon for the podcast, which you can find at patreon.com/homeedvoices. The patrons will get extra stuff, they'll get extra book chat, Q&As, etc. But if you can't do that, or you don't want to do that, that's fine. You can also rate and review at Apple Podcasts, as that helps more people find out about the podcast. The Homeed Voices podcast is an independent production and is created, hosted and produced by me, Katie Hanrot. The podcast theme tune is Hope for Tomorrow by C-Stock. You can subscribe to the podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, YouTube or anywhere else where podcasts are found. I'll be back with a new episode very soon. But in the meantime, stay safe and as much as is possible under the circumstances, here's to more Homeed adventures.